Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turtletaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining me today from the Cleveland, Ohio area is Casey Ingram. Casey's the General Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer for ISK Americas. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today, Casey.
Thanks, Adam. I appreciate the opportunity.
So we're going to talk today about Casey's background in the Navy, and really this topic is going to be how does that background end up helping with compliance and what it's helped bring to his compliance career. So Casey, first, I think it would be good if you told the folks about your background and what you actually did while you were serving.
Well, I attended the U.S. Naval Academy after high school, and then when I graduated, I was selected for submarine duty. All submarine officers are required to become nuclear engineers, so I spent my first year being trained as a nuclear engineer. Then I went to a submarine officer basic course, and then I went to the USS Henry M. Jackson, which is a ballistic missile submarine based out of Seattle, Washington. Ballistic missile submarine, its duty is strategic deterrence. So it carries a payload of nuclear ballistic missiles, which have a very long range, goes out under the water and just hides. And the entire premise is that no aggressor will make a first strike on the U.S. because they know that these submarines will provide a counterattack that will destroy them as well. It's the whole idea behind strategic deterrence.
And I should interrupt and point out by that point that, you know, those submarines, the key is that they're underwater and no one knows where they are for weeks, if not months at a time, correct?
Correct. The only people that truly know where we are us. You just go out and disappear. Wow. But there's constant communication back, and it's passive. So instead of sending back and forth communications, you just listen until you get the appropriate launch codes to launch. But there are so many controls in place. It takes four different people. You have to go through multiple codes. There's multiple keys required. So my first 2 years on the sub, I worked in the nuclear engineering department. I worked as an electrical officer and then the reactor controls officer. And that was a very technical job in that I had a group of electricians or a group of electronics technicians that reported to me. And we were responsible for maintaining all the electrical equipment and all the controls equipment to keep the reactor safe. And then my last year and a half, I was just strategic missile officer. And I reported to the weapons officer. And my job was to run the divisions that did the launching and targeting of the ballistic missiles, and then nuclear weapons safety and security. And part of the nuclear weapons security is you have multiple keys and you have different people who own different sets of keys and control them. And it's you're constantly getting audited and monitored, and there is no room for error because of the consequences are so high.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I also imagine the consequences are so high if you're not doing such a good job taking care of the nuclear reactor as well. So after you left the Navy, what led you into the world of compliance?
Well, I went to law school after I left the Navy, and then I was in private practice for a while. And one of my clients got raided by the EPA. And I went out there, this was a little over 10 years ago, to help with the investigation. And in the process of doing the investigation, we noticed a lot of the areas were not because people were doing willful noncompliance, but there weren't procedures in place to let them know what they needed to do right. And so actually one of the senior executives said, this guy was a submarine officer. If anybody knows procedures he does, have him fix it. And so I spent the next 4.5 years developing a program. There was a whole team of us that set in controls to let people know what they needed to do and when it needed to be done to prevent future violations.
So it really was, in many ways, oddly an extension of your career in the Navy. So obviously, as you're going through that, and he talked about the whole idea of controls, you know, really was drawing on your Navy background. So both at the Academy as an officer, was there training that you received that proved particularly relevant in your work later in the world of compliance?
Well, in the world of, you know, there's always compliance and ethics. And it's interesting, the first training that I felt was substantive was the ethics side of it that then led into the compliance. During orientation for the Naval Academy, a commander got up in front of all of us. There were a little over 1,200 new midshipmen. And he said, just because you're a high performer doesn't mean you have high character. And so we have an honor program here that we want to weed out the people who do not have high character. And I was fortunate enough, I actually ended up on the honor committee and got to do investigations, both prosecuting people who were accused of violations and defending people who were accused of violations. And then there was a large cheating scandal while I was there, and I got to help with the reforms. And so from having learned through the violations what we saw people do and not do, that helped us institute reforms to try to prevent future cheating scandals. And then that carried on into the fleet. Every submarine officer is authorized to be a prosecutor. So if there is a investigation that needs to be done, you don't carry lawyers at sea. You have the officers conduct the investigations. So I would learn how to do the investigation, then you would see problems of where an issue occurred and you would fix it. And at the same time, when I was talking, say, nuclear weapons security earlier, we would have manuals that would tell us this is what you're allowed to do and you're not allowed to do. So every time we were sent to do something, I would consult the manual, then I would go to the captain to get permission, I would explain what I was going to do, I would show how it comported with the manual and met the requirements, and then he would approve it. And the mindset of constantly, okay, what's the right answer? Is what I'm doing comply with the right answer? And then I prove to someone that I'm doing the right answer. And it's very methodical. But it all starts from the integrity value and then into operational compliance.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let me go back. One thing you said that I found particularly notable is you talked about when you were at the academy as part of the, what did you call it, the honor group or
Honor committee.
honor committee, you actually had to look at things from both sides depending on the case. Am I getting that right? That you were either process sort of prosecuting or judging or you were defending?
Correct.
That must have given you tremendous perspective, not only on how to set up controls to make things go right, but also how easy it is for people to go wrong and what leads them to.
And one thing I saw there, plus I've seen throughout my career, is most people who have a violation never intended to actually do it. Willful noncompliance has been pretty rare in my experience.
So it's generally don't know or sort of led down, started down a path and ended up in a place they didn't want to be.
They thought they were doing the right thing based on what they knew at the time, or maybe they didn't think it through, or they didn't think about the consequences, and that's what got them in trouble.
Well, it's fascinating and not all that different from what I hear from most people day to day as to how a lot of the troubles start. And then the other thing that you mentioned I thought was interesting is going back and forth with the captain on what the procedures you are that wanted, you know, that you wanted to put in place. I imagine that back and forth in those situations, something that actually helped a lot as later on as you were dealing with management as well and learning what it takes to get people to see why what you want to do is the right thing.
It does because you have to be quick. A captain doesn't have a whole lot of time and he has a lot of responsibility. So you don't want to be the officer that wastes his time. You want to be able to walk in, explain the problem, explain your solution, and get an answer. And the quicker you can do that and always have the right answer, the easier it is to get the attention.
Yeah, it's good advice. So now let's talk about when we talk about compliance, we talk about ethics, let's talk about culture, which is sort of the third leg of the stool. Having the right culture and the right decision making has to be critical, you know, on any ship, but especially one that spends, as we talked about, weeks, if not months at a time, underwater, isolated, cut off from the rest of the world. Obviously, I've known from talking with you, others who've been in the Navy, and others who've been on subs, that there's a lot of emphasis that gets placed on setting the right culture. You know, how is that done, and what do you think all of us could learn from that?
The culture itself always started with the same core values of honor, courage, and commitment. And the idea behind that, because it started to be developed when I was in, was you have people from very disparate backgrounds that are coming in, and you want to set a simple core of values that each of them follows. But that in and of itself is not enough. That's just something to build upon. When you get on a submarine, it all starts from the culture of excellence. It's difficult to get selected for submarine duty, and as soon as you come on board, you're expected to qualify as a either an enlisted submarine dolphins or your officer submarine dolphins. and there's a qualification process that's very strenuous, and everyone's put through that. And once you get through that, that helps build the culture because there's an excellence required to achieve those goals. There's also an accountability. I don't know if you remember several years ago, it's probably been 15 or 20, there was a submarine off the coast of Hawaii that surfaced and hit a Japanese trawler that killed several Japanese students that were on board the trawler. It missed the trawler because some junior sonarman just did not see the blip on the screen. The captain lost his command. The culture of accountability that the leader loses command, regardless whether he made the mistake or not, is very strong. And there's a strong sense of accountability. If you're an officer, you're responsible for what your men do, whether you were there or not. I actually think that is a great culture that, if it went into corporate America, would be better. The person in charge sets the culture, and if it goes wrong, they take the hit.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought, and one that society goes back and forth on when there's a scandal of, is this laid at the feet of the CEO or is it farther down the line? Well, I have to say you've made quite a case for how veterans can be useful for compliance, and I think I'm getting the sense that you very much feel strongly that they are good candidates to be compliance officers.
Well, and just following up on the culture of accountability, it works in submarine community at least because there is a speak-up culture. There's a nuclear regulation in the naval regulations that says, regardless how low your rank is, if you receive an order that you think could cause an incident, you're supposed to question it and not perform it. And you do not get in trouble. The regulations state that very clearly because they want everyone to own what's going on and be accountable for it. And if you see something your captain may not see, you owe him the obligation to let him know what's going on. And that speak-up attitude creates a huge difference in how you operate the ship. And in fact, I remember on another submarine, there was a captain that was relieved of command. He didn't do anything wrong. There were no incidents. But the admiral went out on a short cruise with him, like 4 or 5 days. And he noticed no one would talk to the captain. And whenever he walked in a room, there was this tension and fear. And he said, if the culture is everybody's afraid to talk to the captain, something bad will happen. And he removed him from command before anything bad did happen. And that kind of culture of, yes, you're accountable, but you're also transparent and everyone can come to the leader and talk to them, stops a lot of compliance violations.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But going back to your question, sorry, I went off on a tangent
No,
there.
that was a very good tangent.
I can't speak for the other services because I'm not in them, but my experience is all services have a similar culture that there's heavy on accountability, heavy on performance. I consider compliance really to be a leadership job more than anything else. There are technical requirements. You really need to understand the business that you're in. But I found in my own career, the business has changed. I can learn a new area. I can figure out a new program. But the leadership that goes with it is really what makes a difference. And when you have men and women who have been put into situations at a young age where they've had to step up and lead, and they've done it under very adverse conditions with very technical equipment, that translates well into walking into a company and saying, all right, let's see where your weak points are, let's see where your strong points are, and let's figure out a way to make sure that the weak points don't become violations.
Yeah, it does sound like very valuable skill. Well, Casey, thank you so much for all that you've done. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspectives.